There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to break from the pace of technology and restore the conditions for the natural cycles of life to reassert themselves. We're always at the mercy of something, but let's choose which something that's going to be. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Thanks for being here. We've posted this episode on or before Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, and later today, Wednesday, April 24th, 2024, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be doing a live-streamed call-in or write-in episode of the show, co-hosted by Team Human's beloved community member and facilitator even, Brynna Campbell. Just come to teamhuman.fm/live. That's teamhuman.fm/live to watch and participate. Members of the Discord can post questions in advance to the questions forum to get priority in the queue. And everyone else, just email questions or things you want to hear discussed to team@teamhuman.fm. That's team@teamhuman.fm, or you'll be able to ask questions in the comments field live as things are happening. All right, I think that's the business of today. I thought I would use today's show to have a frank talk with you. I mean, it sounds grim, but what I've been thinking is that I can't do this anymore. And I don't mean everything. I'm happy to write and podcast and teach and talk. That's me, and that's all good. What I'm finding difficult, even counterproductive, is to try to keep doing this work at the pace of the internet, or maybe it's the pace of capitalism. I'm not sure. Maybe they're the same thing. Podcasting is great fun, and it's super meaningful. And if it were lucrative enough, I could probably record and release one or two episodes a week without breaking too much of a sweat. But that's the pace encouraged by both the advertising algorithms and the patronage platforms. Advertisers can more easily bid for spots on a show with a predictable schedule on specified days. And likewise, paying subscribers, they've come to expect regular content from the podcasts they support, or at least the platforms encourage a regular rhythm, and they embed subtle cues for consistency, certainly to creators, and I think also to patrons. So Substack, while it's great for a lot of things, it's even worse as far as its implied demand for near daily output. I mean, if I really wanted to live off a Substack writing career, I would have to ramp up to at least 3 posts a week. And that might work if I were a beat reporter covering sports. But really, how many cogent ideas about media, society, technology, and change can one person develop over the course of a week? I mean, and more important, how many ideas can one person come up with that are truly worth other people's time? I mean, the Rushkoff take on what? The Trump trial, the Columbia protest, the guy that set himself on fire, the tornadoes over here. I mean, like I have opinions or should have responses and considered responses to each one of those things. I mean, I don't even read the weekly, semi-weekly, actually, twice weekly output of Paul Krugman, Tom Friedman, or any of the New York Times A-list commentators. I feel like I'm reading the same column again and again with slight variations. It's like kind of Bach variations on a theme. You know, for that experience, I'd rather listen to the Grateful Dead channel, where each concert version of Dark Star is a unique instance of something fundamentally familiar. Making matters worse, the pace of the internet, it actually increases with the growth of the platforms, where print and television, they may have been a regular grind. The internet it's an accelerating grind. No sooner do you get used to the one pace of production than the platform, it seems to demand more. More posts, more micro content to support those posts, and then more networks on which to post and cross post all of that content and micro content. It's because a platform's profits can't grow exponentially without accelerating the hamster wheels on which its users run. I get it. It's just the industrial age expressing the values of increased productivity to all of us through platforms that can substitute for the commands of the taskmaster with pacing and leading of the digital environment itself. So where freelancers like me, we used to internalize the mean boss, now our technologies do that for us. And while I love being able to engage with readers and listeners and Discord members through many modes, I'm coming to realize that my sense of, guilty obligation to all the people on all these platforms, it's misplaced. The platforms themselves, they're configured to tug on those triggers of responsibility, the same way that Snapchat uses the streak feature to keep tween girls messaging each other every day. They're not messaging out of social obligation to the other human being, but to keep the platform's metric rising. It's early training, I guess, for the way their eventual economic precarity will keep them checking for how much money a Medium post has earned or how many new subscribers were generated by a Substack post. Most ironically, perhaps, the more content we churn out for all of these platforms, the less valuable all of our content becomes. There's simply too much stuff. The problem isn't information overload so much as perspective abundance. You know, there's just so many perspectives out there in print and voice and video. We may need to redefine discipline. from the ability to write and publish something every day to the ability to hold back, right? That's a nice definition of discipline. I'm disciplined about not posting. What if people started to produce content when they actually had something to say, rather than coming up with something to say in order to fill another necessary slot of content demanded by the platform? So I'm going to try that. It's how I always worked in the past. I remember when Blogger started, I would use the platform to write a 1,000-word piece every couple of weeks. People would comment that I was using it wrong, that Blogger was supposed to be a daily web blog, thus blog. But I ended up growing an audience anyway. And I think they actually appreciated that I only asked for their eyeballs if I thought what I had to share was worth their time. Now, here I am. I'm doing a podcast every week, which means, what, finding guests to fill slots rather than finding slots to share friends and ideas with you. You know, that's a reversal. It's not fair to anybody, particularly when there's so many podcasts and radio shows on which so many of the same people and friends are appearing. You know, that's probably why, I don't know if I'm, am I allowed to share stats? I guess I am. Probably why, you know, it turns out the interview shows that we do on Team Human, they've got significantly smaller audiences than the monologues. It's interesting. I'm not saying it's because of me, right? It's not that, oh, we want to hear Doug so much, as the fact that the other stuff is more commodified. If you're seeing some author who's got a book and had been on three or four other shows that week, you kind of hear them once or twice. Do you need to hear them again with Doug? Maybe, but maybe not. You know, back when we started the Team Human podcast, I remember listeners actually, they were emailing to say that our episodes were so rich, right? That's nice. They were so rich that they wanted more time to digest them. They were actually complaining that the weekly output was just too much to process. They wanted to have more time so they could have a second listen or a third listen or sit and think and dream and have time to just digest it. They were complaining, right? They wanted less. So we dropped down to once every other week, which did kind of feel more natural. It was that way for a few years, but that was before COVID and the loss of all those speaking gigs because no one was traveling or showing up anyway. It was before Medium shut down its magazines and stopped paying writers like me to do, you know, special pieces, before I had to start paying college tuition and bills, and before I found myself kind of enmeshed in the value system of views and opens and CPMs, you know? All my friends, all the writers, everybody was going onto these platforms and doing all these things. And I figured, well, I could do that too. But honestly, from my current experience and what I'm feeling like, it's not worth it. You know, it just isn't. What I value most, and hopefully what I offer, is an alternative to the pacing and values of digital industrialism. That's what I'm here for, to express and even model a human approach to living in a digital media environment. So I am getting off the treadmill, recognizing the assembly line for what it is, and trusting that you will stay with me on this journey in recognition of the fact that less is more. I've got one other thing to share with you. Maybe it's related. I think it is. And that's, I tried to use AI over the last month. I've been working on a graphic novel. And yes, because I've been doing too much, I haven't had enough time to really immerse in the world of this thing and do it the way I want to. And I've got a friend, a comedian, who's been doing a lot of AI. He's actually using AI to help a famous comedian write a movie script. And he's like, Doug, you can do it. It'll work. It's going to be great. So there's like basically the way AI works is there's kind of two columns. There's this column on the left where you enter in all the things like the story that I want to tell and the values that it has and examples of my other work. And then there's this column on the right where you kind of ask it questions. You ask it to produce things. And I'm doing all this work, you know, my writing paragraphs explaining each character and what the story's supposed to do, because that's all inside me. This is all information I have. And I got to teach the AI, what is this world? Who are the people? What's the story I want to have happen and all that? So I could see, okay, try writing a scene where this happens and see what it does. But what I realized as I was doing that was I was doing all the grunt work, and the AI was going to get to have the fun of actually coming up with the scenes, right? I was becoming the servant to the AI, and the AI was doing the most fun part of the whole process, right? The actual coming up of the stuff. And I realized that's kind of what we're doing with AI now, is especially kind of turning Hollywood over and the creative industries over to AI or the drawing of pictures. So what? So you're going to do the boring part, like make a web page or figure out what everything has to be and then give it like the climax, give it the coolest part of the whole process, you know? I mean, I'll do that with students, right? Help them set up, talk to them, kind of interview them to help them write an outline so then they can go and actually write the paper or write their short story. But, you know, here it's like, wait a minute, this is my comic. This is my comic. And the other thing that happened that occurred to me was, you know, as I was doing this, I finally got it to the place where it was going to write a scene. And it was a scene I'd already written, but I was like, okay, now we're going to let it kind of write the scene. And some of the elements in the scene that the AI wrote were like really close to stuff in my scene. You know, there was like a little section, you know, a page or so of like, well, that's the same thing I wrote. And my immediate response was, well, if that's the same thing I wrote, then I'm going to change what I wrote. Because the way, you know, the way that AIs work is they write the most cliche thing possible. That's what they're doing. They're modeling a story based on all the stories that came before. So they look at all my questions and the things I said, and then they go look at everything else that's ever been written and take the average of it in order to produce the most likely scene. So I started to think that the real value of AIs is to have them write stuff, have them generate the same thing that you're doing, right? The same, the answer the same questions, but then look and use what the AI produced to know how not to write, right? You know what I mean? It's like the AI is going to write the Marvel Universe. Well, not everything bad is bad in the Marvel Universe, but you know what I mean? They're going to write the mean, the most average, the literally, by definition, the mediocre version of the thing. So that's a great way to see. And as a writer, it's a real problem. Always, you know, you, whenever you're writing and you kind of lose the real muse, the way you know you've fallen off the muse, the way you know you're not really in the creative space anymore, is that you start writing in a cliche. You start writing stuff that's in any sci-fi story or any movie. You're really writing from your memory of the movies and plays and comics and stuff that you've already absorbed. So when you see the AI starting to do the thing that you're doing, it's how you know, okay, stop, take a breath. In some ways, it goes to what I was talking about earlier. It means that you're kind of pushing now. You've gotten to a place, where you're not comfortable. And rather than taking a breath and letting this sort of creative activity arise in you, you're starting to fall back on cliche, on tricks, on the stuff you've seen before. So I love the idea of using AI in the creative process, but not to create the stuff. You're using the AI to check your work, almost to see if you've cheated the same way an AI cheats. Have you cheated? Have you gone back? And if you did go back, and if you are using cliche, then at least do it consciously. Wink, wink. See where it came from. Am I just telling Raiders of the Lost Ark? Am I just in the second Star Wars movie? Am I back in Westworld? And then if you are and you really do love it, then at least acknowledge the source. Steal a real line, wink, wink to the audience and say, yeah, I'm riffing on Westworld here. And then it's kind of all good again. But in most cases, it's an opportunity to stop, go back, take a breath, and return to the human, right? return to the place again. The other thing I was thinking, and it's funny, an idea occurred to me while I was just doing a talk at this wonderful college in Tennessee. It's called Middle Tennessee State University. They got this great program in kind of music management and a lot of really smart, interested, open-minded young people thinking about the future of all this stuff. And I was talking about AI, and it occurred to me that since what AIs do is commodify stuff, like they commodify art, they're trying to commodify writing, they're trying to commodify screenplays, they commodify everything, that if you are in a business and you start to rely on AI, and since everybody's basically using the same AI, all you're doing is commodifying your own work, that if you're going to move into an AI type industry or let AI take over what you're doing and commodify it, then it's going to require you establish a monopoly. Right? You've lost your competitive advantage. That's what you've done by using an AI, by overusing technology, by relying on the same technologies as everybody else. You're now commodified. So the only chance you have now of surviving, because you've got no competitive advantage, you've given away your creative, your human, your unique competitive advantage, your special sauce is gone. The only chance you're going to have is by establishing a monopoly. And that's why you look at these companies, that's all they want to do, tech bro companies, is establish a monopoly, because it's the only way to survive in the world that they are creating. And they didn't start that. This is what started way back. This was, with the printing press and the commodification of letters. It was the beginning. Commodification of labor came with the printing press and hourly wages and assembly lines, where humans became interchangeable. That's only happened because, and we've talked about this before, because that was the moment that we got what were called chartered monopolies. His Majesty's Royal Shoe Company, that is the official chartered monopoly in shoes. So there's no need for competition. So there's no need for innovation anymore. The only place you innovate is on reducing the cost of production by creating an assembly line, hiring people from the Home Depot parking lot, paying them less than minimum wage, and not letting them complain. So incorporate these technologies into your process at your own peril. If you're going to use them to make what you do, then you're commodifying yourself and you better find a monopoly to join. But I suggest you use them like I do, to zig when they're zagging and zag when they're zigging. The same thing with this time thing. You look at these platforms, they want weekly output, they want daily output, and everybody gets used to that daily output, weekly output, daily output. What is the thing they're going to notice? The thing they're going to notice is the person who's like marching to the beat of a different drummer, doing the thing, disappearing for a couple of weeks and then showing up with a totally new idea. I mean, make like Beyonce, right? She vanishes for a year or two and comes back with a friggin' country record. That's it. That's my goal, to come back like Beyonce with a country record. Well, we'll see. Next week, 2 weeks, whenever it is I'm back, I'll be back. I'm coming back. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just breaking with the industrial periodicity and coming back in new and ever more human forms. Maybe we'll talk later today, or take a listen in a week or two and see what we've come up with. Thanks for being on Team Human. I'm Douglas Rushkoff. The show is produced by Joshua Chapdelin, edited by Luke Robert Mason, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.